How did Adolf Hitler, an Austrian who came out of nowhere, succeed in conquering Germany? How did he sow the seeds of hatred and violence? And how did Hitler and the Nazis drag the world into the apocalypse of the Second World War? To tell this story, the best footage of the rise of Adolf Hitler has been painstakingly transformed using digital techniques into color. To ask the question, how was the Hitler phenomenon possible? In his book, Mein Kampf, Hitler wrote, "The First World War was the most unforgettable and most sublime moment in my earthly existence." For 4 years, Corporal Hitler was a courier, carrying messages for the Bavarian 16th Infantry Regiment. He ran from trench to trench, delivering the soldiers their orders. It was a dangerous job. He was decorated with the Iron Cross. He always wore his Iron Cross underneath his Nazi Party insignia. During the First World War, Hitler learned utter disdain for the value of human life, as did many other soldiers in this appalling conflict. But it was in the war that Hitler gradually became a fanatical nationalist. Also in the trenches, the confused idea was born that one day he would bear witness and stand up for his companions by getting into politics. Hitler always knew how to exploit his camaraderie with fellow war veterans, as here, 15 years later, in a speech to workers at the Siemens factory.
First, Genossen und Genossinnen, meine deutschen Arbeiter, ich bin aus euch selbst herausgewachsen, bin einst selbst unter euch gestanden, bin in 4,5 Jahren Krieg wieder mitten unter euch gewesen und habe mich dann durch Fleiß, durch Lernen und ich kann sagen durch Hungern langsam emporgearbeitet. In meinem innersten Wesen bin ich immer das geblieben, was ich vorher war.
A succession of events accelerated his political awakening. On the night of the 13th of October, 1918, a gas shell temporarily blinded Hitler. He was evacuated to a field hospital, and then to Germany. Meanwhile, at the front, the Germans were pushed back, and finally capitulated. The German army retreated in good military order with its weapons intact. These soldiers never forgot the bitterness of a defeat that was portrayed by extreme right-wing propagandists as caused by Germany's unpatriotic elements, those who negotiated with the enemy. It was then that an event occurred in Hitler's life that he always considered a turning point. He slowly recovered and regained his sight in the Pasewalk military hospital north of Berlin, where the army treated cases of shell shock. Hitler recounted that when he heard of Kaiser Wilhelm's abdication, the end of the German monarchy, and the armistice of the 11th of November 1918 that marked Germany's defeat, he heard an inner voice. He later wrote, "This voice called to me to free the German people and to restore Germany's greatness." Added to this was one of his enduring obsessions. For him, in 1918, the German eagle was stabbed by the Jews. Anti-Semitism went back centuries and knew no borders. Throughout history, the Jews, whether poor and living in ghettos or bourgeois and assimilated, often became scapegoats in times of crisis. In Russia at the beginning of the 20th century, the Jews were victims of pogroms, massacres. Many who fled the persecution settled in Germany. The 20th of April, 1889, Adolf Hitler was born to a Catholic family in what was then the Austro-Hungarian Empire, in Braunau am Inn, a small town on the border with the German Empire. His father was a customs officer. A widower, he remarried his much younger cousin. During Hitler's early childhood, the family moved often as his father's workplace moved up and down the border. Hitler was a model student during primary school, and at eight, he was an altar boy in this monastery. He sang in the choir and admired the priest's self-sacrifice and sense of mission. He noticed a strange cross upon the monastery's pediment. It prefigured the swastika, which later became the Nazi emblem. Hitler always remembered the monastery's cross as if it were a portent of his destiny. Later, Hitler would create a myth around the youth of Germany, all part of the mystique of the master race.
Da muss der deutsche Junge der Zukunft blank und rank sein. Flink wie Windhunde, zäh wie Leder und hart wie Grundstahl. Wir sind entschlossen, ein neues Geschlecht heranzuziehen.
Growing up, Hitler did not correspond to this ideal. He returned to this Austrian landscape at important moments in his career, like this one, a few weeks before his invasion of Poland and the beginning of the Second World War. Images of his childhood home, filmed and edited by his mistress, Eva Braun, were entitled The Führer Visits the Homeland of His Childhood, 12th of June, 1939. He stops to place flowers on his parents' graves, as was the custom. He bore no resentment towards his father, a strict disciplinarian who drank heavily. But his mother, who died from cancer at age 47, was the only person Hitler ever really loved. She pampered him enormously, and even in his bunker during his final hours, Hitler carried her portrait with him. Hitler fell out with his father, who wanted him to become a civil servant. But Hitler never went far in school, arrogantly considering himself above the education system. At 19, after his mother's death, he left for Vienna. Politics was a long way from his mind as he dreamed of attending the Beaux Arts Academy. Thanks to his modest inheritance, he was able to live the bohemian artist's life. Vienna, at this time, was one of Europe's intellectual centres. Hitler admired the lifestyle of the upper classes, against which the red flags of the socialist activists were unfurled. Having left his home province, he discovered the many different communities living in the Austro-Hungarian capital. Czechs, Poles, Italians, Croatians, and Jews. He later wrote, "It appeared to me like the incarnation of racial profanation." He made a try at the Beaux Arts entrance exam, but he barely prepared for it because despite all his ambition, he had little courage. He failed. The period that followed was a difficult one. He lived in a boarding house for men and survived by copying postcards for tourists. With the little money he earned, he attended the opera to hear Wagner, which, as a friend recounted, sent Hitler into a trance. Hitler, whose everyday life was mediocre at best, dreamt of these heroes of Germanic legend. One of his favorite operas was Rienzi, in which a young warrior takes on the mission of saving his people. Mobilization. Hitler was 25, and the declaration of war in 1914 transformed the life of the failed artist. Earlier, to escape military service, he had fled Austria. Now he was in Germany, in Munich, swept up in the folly of extreme nationalist sentiment that was hurtling all of Europe towards the slaughter of the Great War. Hitler has been identified in the midst of this crowd, enthusiastically welcoming the declaration of war. This photo reappeared opportunely during the 1932 election campaign. The Nazis made sure it was widely viewed. Their adversaries denounced it as a fake. But one thing is certain. Hitler fought in the Great War, and the war was to transform him. After 4 years of war, Adolf Hitler returned to Munich, to a Germany in the throes of revolution. He was 30 years old. New opportunities now opened up before him. Above all, he wanted to remain in the army, which guaranteed order and stability for the new regime of the Social Democrat president, Friedrich Ebert. The young German Republic had to deal with the Marxist revolutionary movement, the Spartacus League, whose members were trying to seize power just like the Bolsheviks had in Russia 2 years before. The army crushed them, aided by volunteer nationalists known as the Free Corps, a recruiting ground for the future Nazi Party. Hitler served in the army with great zeal. His primary goal was to keep a roof over his head, for which he'd stoop to anything. He became a provocateur, an informer, denouncing comrades he suspected of being Reds. His superior officers, whose duties included combating radical communist ideas, were impressed with his anti-revolutionary fervor. They gave Hitler a mission: to politically re-educate returning German soldiers and prisoners of war. Hitler's commanding officer wrote, "He's a natural-born orator. His fanaticism and populism captivates listeners, forcing one to think as he does." Hitler said, "At that moment, I understood that I knew how to speak." Next, he learned how to use theatrical effects in order to dominate his audience. This 1933 film, with its original soundtrack, shows his ability to build a sense of drama. From his beginnings, Hitler knew how to handle an audience and to feed his listeners with exactly what they wanted to hear. In 1919, he denounced the national shame of the Treaty of Versailles. After months of discussions among themselves, the victors, France, Britain, and the United States, imposed harsh peace terms on Germany, as if it alone were responsible for the massive carnage. The Treaty of Versailles, signed on the 28th of June 1919, condemned Germany to pay enormous reparations, which placed an immense burden on the economy and became a central issue in Germany's popular grievances. Germany also saw 13% of its territories and one-tenth of its population taken from it. Alsace-Lorraine once again became French, and the Rhine's entire left bank was demilitarized. A German film of the period mocked the carving up of the national territory. The worst was the separation of East Prussia from Germany to reconstitute Poland, partitioned in the 18th century, giving it access to the sea. The Polish corridor would be the spark that ultimately ignited the Second World War. For many Germans, the Allies' demand that the paramilitary anti-revolutionary forces must be disarmed added insult to injury. The German people witnessed the destruction of their submarines. Their battleships. And their air force. Germany's army was reduced to 100,000 men. Hitler, against his wishes, was demobilized into Bavaria, a region in upheaval, where right-wing extremist groups were multiplying. Here he was filmed for the first time, during a demonstration of the DAP, the German Workers' Party. In 1919, the army had ordered him to infiltrate and spy on this group. But now he remained a member and developed into a full-time political agitator. Politically, Bavaria was on the far right. Whereas power in Berlin was with the centre-left Weimar Republic, named after the city where the new constitution had just been voted into law. Hitler, now transformed from an Austrian into a dyed-in-the-wool Bavarian, howled with rage against the November criminals, the signatories of the armistice and of the shameful Versailles Treaty. These sentiments were shared by the army, especially by the war veterans who gathered in Munich's large beer halls. One of these is the Bürgerbraukeller, where, on August the 13th, 1920, Hitler made his political debut with a lecture entitled, Why Are We Anti-Semitic? For Hitler, the answer, beyond his intense hatred for the Jews since the German defeat, is that anti-Semitism was the best strategy for attracting nationalist militants. Hitler galvanized the radicals of his small right-wing extremist group. They made him their leader and equipped him with a car, evidence of his importance. Hitler changed the party's name, associating the terms national and socialism. His goal was to create a much wider appeal and to show his anti-capitalist stance. The DAP was now the NSDAP. The National Socialist German Workers' Party, the abbreviated form of which is Nazi. In his small headquarters in a Munich beer hall, he drew his party's emblem. He wrote in Mein Kampf, "After innumerable attempts, I chose a red flag to show our movement's social dimension, with a white circle representing our nationalism, and the swastika, symbol of the Aryan, the eternal anti-Semite." To protect their meetings, he created the SA Stormtroopers, his assault unit, a small militia whose uniforms he obtained from the stock of the former Austro-Hungarian Customs Office. His radicalism increased the party's membership from 2,000 to 20,000, growing tenfold in a single year. He succeeded with the help of a racist sect, the Thule Society, named after a legendary Nordic kingdom. Its members financed a newspaper. This publication became the official Nazi Party newspaper under a new title, Volksche Beobachter, the racist People's Observer. Its editor, Alfred Rosenberg, was a member of the Thule Society and acted as the theoretician of anti-Semitism. Confused, if not deranged, he would become an important inspirer of Nazi philosophy. Another former member of the Thule Society during his student days was Rudolf Hess. He went on to become Hitler's secretary and one of his most servile and fanatical accomplices. Another addition to the ranks of the early militants was a First World War hero, Hermann Göring, one of Germany's most celebrated fighter pilots. Like many other veterans, he had difficulty readapting to civilian life. In Hitler, he found someone who articulated his own anti-revolutionary ideas. Göring would become the number two of the Nazi regime and an instigator of the concentration camps. In 1922, at a political march, Hitler placed Göring next to General Ludendorff, still wearing his spiked helmet, to show the veterans that their great wartime chief supported the Nazis. Ludendorff, one of the most senior German generals from the war, was convinced that the politicians had denied him his victory. The theory was shared by many German generals. Ludendorff's support for nationalist ideas opened up new perspectives for Hitler. Everything seemed possible. In Italy, the extreme right, Benito Mussolini's fascist party, had just seized power. Will Hitler be the German Mussolini? 1923 will be the decisive year. January 11th, 1923. Stunned Germans watch helplessly as French and Belgian soldiers took control of the Ruhr, Germany's mining and steel production region. This followed on from Germany's refusal to pay its war reparations, the fines imposed by the Treaty of Versailles. The French and Belgians took payment in the form of coal. In response, the German government ordered passive resistance, a miners' and rail workers' strike. The French simply replaced all the strikers. No coal was left for the Germans. The situation became dangerously tense. On the 10th of March 1923, a French officer was assassinated. His coffin was sent back through Germany to France, and French officers slapped any Germans who didn't remove their hats. These images would be profitably exploited by the Nazis, along with the death of 13 Krupp factory workers killed by the French on the 31st of March. Germans were cold. Germans were hungry. They tried to steal coal back from the French, but the Weimar Republic had to import its coal and pay the striking miners. These enormous expenses prompted the mint to begin printing huge quantities of new money. The mark plummeted dramatically. One day, Germans had to pay 1 billion marks for a kilo of potatoes, and the next day, 460 billion for a loaf of bread. In this ferment of hyperinflation and unemployment, The Bavarian extreme right mobilized, with General Ludendorff as its leader. Thanks to Ludendorff, Hitler managed to unite all the veteran groups embittered by the defeat and the economic chaos. He wanted to attempt a putsch, a coup, to march on Munich, and then Berlin. Hitler said, "Our people are subjected to such extreme economic conditions that if we don't act now, they'll desert and join the communists." Thanks to their accomplices in the army, the Nazis succeeded in procuring guns. But after hesitating, the army and police decided to remain loyal to the legal government. For Hitler in Munich, all seemed lost. But he held on to the wild fantasy that he and Ludendorff could still bring the population along with them. So he ordered his supporters to advance on the police barricades. The two sides were face to face, with Hitler in his white coat in the middle. In fact, this was a Nazi photo montage creating the myth of Hitler's courage. In reality, he was cringing behind a bodyguard who was killed in the shooting. When the police opened fire, Hitler's 1923 putsch came to an end. 10 years later, after taking power, Hitler instituted a funeral celebration resembling a Nordic pagan rite every 9th of November, in commemoration of the 14 Nazis killed during the putsch attempt. Their names were called out, and every year in response, thousands of Nazis and Hitler Youth shouted, "Present." Hitler had a mausoleum built in Munich, and Germans were obliged to parade through it, their arms raised in memory of those Hitler called the November Martyrs. They had to salute the mausoleum when strolling by, or even on a bicycle. Further exploiting the putsch myth, Hitler created yet another grandiose Nazi ceremony, the bloodied flag. At each year's party congress in Nuremberg, he took the sacred blood-stained relic of the putsch and with exaggerated forceful gestures he touched it to the new Nazi party's flags, as if to consecrate them. This quasi-mystical celebration is part and parcel of how the Nazis falsified history. The reality was that Hitler had badly prepared his putsch, that was improvised and haphazard. He showed himself to be impulsive, ignoring the possible consequences. All of these staged ceremonies record a fiasco, which could have put an end to the Nazi adventure. After the putsch failed, Hitler was arrested, and the National Socialist Party was banned. In February 1924, the trial of the rebels opened in Munich. Hitler was accused of high treason and the murder of 4 police officers, crimes punishable by the death penalty. Ludendorff, who had not even been incarcerated, arrived at the trial in a smart car with his lawyers. He was let off without further ado, out of respect for his glorious past, and because he continued to have influential supporters. He was acquitted of all charges. Hitler, who had threatened to kill himself, now realized the court was not as hostile as he first thought. He drew on all his talents as an orator and launched his usual fiery invective towards the government and the Jews. The trial became an unexpected pulpit. The judges became more and more sympathetic, and the public thronged to get in. As a result, the verdict was much less severe than Hitler feared. He was condemned to 5 years in a relatively comfortable cell with plenty of provisions. His imprisonment was more like a stay in a hotel, and he was free to receive Nazi sympathizers at any time of the day. And Hitler was also free to receive any news publications he wanted, and he even began to read Karl Marx. Rudolf Hess, jailed for 15 months for his role in the putsch, had the neighboring cell and joined the small group who regularly discussed infighting between the right-wing parties who were tearing each other apart. Hitler's return soon became a necessity. His accomplices on the outside devised a strategy to have his release brought forward. Realizing he would soon be freed, Hitler felt the need to write down his particular view of life and his political principles. He dictated a book to Rudolf Hess, who typed it on a machine provided by a banker and on paper brought by Winifred Wagner, the daughter-in-law of Hitler's idolized composer. Like Wagner, Winifred was a racist and a great admirer of her good friend, Adolf. Nazi journalists rewrote his hurriedly dictated manuscript. Hitler wanted to name the book 4.5 years of struggle against lies, foolishness, and cowardice. But the title was considered too long and was changed to Mein Kampf, meaning my struggle. Even rewritten, the book remained unreadable. And yet it contained Hitler's entire worldview, and the Nazis made it their Bible. Transcribed like the Holy Scriptures, copies were bound like the great medieval manuscripts. Hitler ranted about the struggle of the master race, the tall, blonde, Aryan Germanic race, about the need to conquer living space, about the eradication of communism and the crushing of the Jews, who, in Hitler's eyes, do not even belong to the human species. At the time, many readers judged the book to be complete madness. But in fact, it should have been read carefully and taken seriously, for its predictions lay at the root of the death of 50 million people. After 20 months in prison, Hitler was released on the 20th of December 1924 on good behavior. Now he dreamt that he was a natural successor to the great founders of the German nation, such as Bismarck. He claimed, "My time in prison brought me confidence, optimism, and a belief that nothing could ever shake me again." And yet, his journey through the political desert was only just beginning. Mein Kampf was a failure, selling barely 20,000 copies. Hitler spent much of his spare time in the Bavarian mountain village of Berchtesgaden, where he rented a small chalet. He met a pretty 16-year-old waitress, Maria Reiter, and they had a brief affair. She wanted to marry Hitler. He refused, suggesting she be his shadow mistress. He would ask the same of the other women in his life, so that nothing could interfere with his mission. She left him. He wrote the second volume of Mein Kampf. It dealt mainly with his project of expanding Germany's living space into Russia. Sales of the book were only average until he took power in 1933. Then Mein Kampf almost became required reading. The German state offered it to couples as a wedding gift. If it wasn't on your bookshelf, you could be denounced by your hired help. It was distributed by Krupp steel executives to their best workers as a reward. Over 80 million copies of Mein Kampf were sold, and it was translated into countless languages. The royalty payments were astronomical, making Hitler a very rich man. On the 17th of February 1925, Hitler made his political comeback in the famous Munich beer hall where he had launched the putsch, reaffirming his leadership of the Nazi party. And on the very next day, an event occurred that would advance his cause. The first president of the Weimar Republic, Social Democrat Friedrich Ebert, the incarnation of the new German democracy, died at 57 from a badly treated case of appendicitis. Germans felt the loss strongly, as his government had succeeded in cutting inflation and the economy was recovering well. Germans now had to elect a new president, and the swastika made its comeback during the political campaign. By now, the ban on the Nazi party had been lifted, as it was no longer considered dangerous. In fact, Ludendorff, the candidate who tried to unite the extreme right parties, won barely 1% of the vote. Ludendorff's failure was what Hitler secretly wanted. It disposed of his main rival, for whom he had only half-heartedly campaigned. Revealing his political instinct, he said, "We gave him the finishing blow." The man the Germans elected as their new president was the other great war commander, Marshal von Hindenburg. Hitler had to wait. The Nazi party continued to spread like a cancer throughout Germany. Its membership reached 170,000. Hitler transformed his stormtroopers into a private army. They looked young and jovial. But this paramilitary order was composed of brutal fanatics, thugs, and killers. Their new uniform earned them the nickname the Brown Shirts. They imitated Mussolini's black shirts, who some years before had marched so successfully on Rome. Another symbol borrowed from Mussolini is the Roman salute, the outstretched arm accompanied by a guttural cry. In Mussolini's case, it was "Viva il Duce." With Hitler, it became "Heil Hitler." Long live Hitler. The SA uniform was created by a select team of German designers. Among the manufacturers was Stuttgart designer Hugo Boss, who promoted it in his ad campaigns. Hugo Boss, a Nazi party member, also produced the terrifying black uniforms of the SS, the Schutzstaffel, Hitler's new protection unit, as well as the Hitler Youth uniforms. This all cost a great deal. The money came from rank-and-file Nazi Party members and from rich sympathizers such as steel magnate Fritz Thyssen, whose steel plants were ready to forge new guns. They also included Henry Ford, the world's largest car manufacturer. The anti-Semitic Henry Ford strongly supported the Nazis by giving them all the profits of Ford's car sales in Germany. In addition, each year on Hitler's birthday, Ford made a personal donation of $50,000, a substantial sum. This was how the Nazis paid for the vast spectacle of their annual party rallies. the banner proclaims Deutschland erwache, Germany awake. In 1927, Hitler chose Nuremberg, a Nazi bastion and a medieval city with a long history and a Wagnerian allure, to bring out the Nazi Party's connections, the Germanic warlords of the Dark Ages. He called Nuremberg his ideological capital. He also wanted to highlight the party's submission to the Führer, its leader. This personality cult was enhanced through the work of his personal photographer, Heinrich Hoffmann. Always at the center of events, a Nazi from the start, a virtuoso with the camera, Hoffmann was never far from his master. He took a series of surprising photographs intended to show the great leader's personal side, to win over female voters. In Hoffmann's small Munich photographic studio, Hitler, inspired as always by Wagner and fascinated by the theatrical movements of opera singers, studied a whole range of gestures conveying domination, which he would use in the first big Nazi rallies. Hitler stated, "The masses are feminine and stupid. Only emotion and hatred can keep them under control." Hatred. This was exactly what the SA was sowing throughout Germany, beginning with the Jewish neighborhoods in large cities. Nazi thugs openly bullied people on the streets. But the intimidation and terror produced only sparse results. In Germany's 1928 parliamentary elections, the Nazis obtained only 2.6% of the vote, less than 1 million ballots. The communists received three times as many, the Central Party 4 million, and the Right 5 million. The Social Democrats came out on top with 10 million votes. Yet in the Reichstag, Berlin's parliament, this 2.6% of ballots, mainly from rural areas, translated into 12 new Nazi deputies. They created quite an impact, as almost all wore their SA uniforms. Among them was Hermann Göring, making his comeback. Wounded in the lower stomach during the putsch, he had gained a lot of weight and had become addicted to morphine. It also marked the grand entrance into politics of Joseph Goebbels. Goebbels was hardly the tall, blonde Aryan type. He was short, had a limp, and suffered from an inferiority complex since childhood due to his club foot. However, his political cunning made up for these handicaps. He was a rebel against society who had flirted with Marxism until the decisive meeting of his life with Adolf Hitler. Goebbels then saw the light. By refusing to publish his manuscripts, the Jewish publishers had prevented him from becoming a great writer, and the communists were responsible for the chaos in society. He stated, "We enter the Reichstag like wolves into the sheep pen." But it was still impossible at this moment for either the public or the deputies to grasp the significance of this statement. The general public's view of the Nazis was that Hitler had no coherent ideas or policies, that he was an outsider and a fanatic. Most Germans were not worried. There was a new prosperity, a new sense of fun. It would surely take a major catastrophe for Hitler to have any serious future in politics. No one then foresaw the crash of 1929 and the Great Depression and how conventional politics would be swept aside. And Hitler would never abandon his mission.
And see part two of Hitler's Rise, the colour films, here on 4 at the same time next week.
When Hitler became dictator of Germany, he applied the principle he wrote in his book, Mein Kampf. A stronger race will drive out the weak races, for the vital urge crushes the weak to make room for the strong. How did Hitler manage to take power and become the supreme leader of Germany, the Führer? To tell this story, the best footage of the rise of Adolf Hitler has been painstakingly transformed using digital techniques into color. To ask the question, how was the Hitler phenomenon possible? Nuremberg, 1929. This Nazi Party rally was the real beginning of what German playwright Bertolt Brecht called the resistible rise of Adolf Hitler. The devastating economic crisis originating with the Wall Street crash in the United States caused havoc throughout the world, particularly in Germany. One after another, factories closed their doors, and the number of unemployed reached the astounding figure of 6 million. Out of despair, many Germans turned to the Nazis or to the communists, who also had their paramilitary troops, complete with uniforms. Communists and Nazis clashed violently in all the elections that followed. Hitler provoked disorder, while at the same time claiming to be the only man capable of stopping it. This tactic proved effective. Hitler rallied the small business owners and homeowners to his cause by denouncing the threat of the Red Plague, the egalitarian Marxists, who also struck fear into the hearts of the peasantry. The result? 100 elected Nazis entered the Reichstag, the German parliament. Hitler was now the leader of the country's second political party, after the Social Democrats. Yet the upper classes, who despised Hitler, weren't particularly worried. They carried on living a lifestyle isolated from the mass of the German people. They saw no reason why things should change. And in the meantime, Hitler's rise continued. In just a year, he came to dominate the extreme right in Germany. Veterans associations, such as the Steel Helmets, with 500,000 members, agreed to obey his orders. Behind his domineering posturing, Hitler hid a terrible secret. He had just emerged from a scandal which might have finished him. Rumors of a personal drama were circulating in the press. He had developed a passion for his own niece, Geli Raubal, aged 23. He loved her irrationally, possessively. And she had just committed suicide. She had been living with him in his Munich apartment. She confided to a friend, "My uncle is a monster. No one can imagine what he demands of me." She apparently wanted to leave him, but now she was dead. A press campaign was launched against Hitler, accusing him of sexual perversion and even of having Geli murdered. Extremely depressed, Hitler threatened to kill himself as well. His worried entourage decided to act. His photographer, Heinrich Hoffmann, introduced him to one of his secretaries. She resembled Geli. Her name was Eva Braun. She was 19 and already quite worldly. She seemed to fit the bill. She was captivated by the popularity of the Nazi party leader. Hitler would make her his new shadow mistress. He declared himself a bachelor married to Germany to gain the sympathy of female voters. German women already had the right to vote. Eva Braun was above all a sports enthusiast. She dreamt of becoming an actress and of starring in Tarzan movies in Hollywood. With her behind him, Hitler recovered his combativeness as a politician at a time when the end of the mandate of Germany's President Hindenburg was drawing near. Hitler was among the candidates to succeed him in 1932. Barely 10 years after his attempted putsch and imprisonment, Hitler was on the verge of becoming president of Germany. Germans were subjected to an intensive poster campaign. Nazi propaganda chief Joseph Goebbels said, "Let us be grandiose." He devised an ultra-modern election campaign using aeroplanes, a European first. The largest commercial plane of the time was provided by the director of Lufthansa Airlines, who wasn't adverse to this free advertising opportunity. Hitler, wearing a leather helmet, embarked on a tour of 100 German towns to gauge his popularity. Goebbels invented the slogan, "The Führer above Germany." He forged the myth of Hitler as the supreme savior during these aerial hustings, carefully filmed and then screened all over the country. But Goebbels could not relax yet. The campaign cost a fortune, and the industrial barons were still wary of Hitler's violent methods. The Nazis had to charge everyone who came to listen to Hitler the equivalent of a £1 entry fee. This didn't discourage people. On the contrary. One witness described his reaction. "I suddenly felt Hitler's eyes on me, and it affected me for the rest of my life." A week before the presidential elections, Hitler brought together 100,000 Berliners, sick of the traditional parties, who appeared incapable of solving the crisis. 20-year-old Jutta Rüdiger was in the crowd. She wrote, "I can't explain the state that unemployment plunged us into. We really thought that Hitler alone could get us out of that misery."
Sie reden nicht von den Zehntausenden, die Jahr für Jahr den Gashahn aufdrehen, nicht weil es ihnen zu gut geht.
To the amazement of many, Hitler became a serious candidate for the presidency. The press had a field day. On the right, Hitler was seen as the modern political hero. On the left, the insults were more personal. Hitler was described as a pansy, a half-mad cheater, a vain charlatan, a fake tough guy with an oversized riding crop. The outgoing president, Marshal Hindenburg, although a reactionary monarchist, was supported by the left. On the 10th of April 1932, the verdict was announced. Hitler had been defeated. 13 million Germans had voted for him, a third of the electorate. Support for him was enormous, but not enough. April 1932. Hindenburg has been re-elected as president of Germany thanks to the Social Democrats. But he wanted to be free of his dependence on them, so he called a new election. And Hitler, continuing his resistible rise, started campaigning again. As he gave up to 5 speeches a day, his entourage was reeling. One of his associates said, "We were like seconds who have to get their boxer back into shape between rounds." But Hitler fed off the crowds. He was carried away by his own virulent oratory.
Die Gegner werfen uns Nationalsozialisten vor und mir insbesondere, dass wir intolerante, unverträgliche Menschen seien. Wir wollten, sagen sie, mit anderen Parteien nicht arbeiten. Die Herren haben ganz recht. Wir sind intolerant. Ich habe mir ein Ziel gesteckt, nämlich die 30 Parteien aus Deutschland hinauszufegen.
For Hitler, the first party to eliminate in the 1932 election campaign was the Communist Party. The stormtroopers were given the task. They were now 400,000 strong. They financed themselves, paying for their own uniforms and equipment. They hated the humiliations of the Versailles Treaty and believed that only Hitler would stand up and build a new Germany. There was great companionship and solidarity among the men who formed the SA legions. Goebbels invented an idol to inspire them, Horst Wessel, a petty crook from Berlin who had become leader of an assault brigade. Killed by the communists a year earlier, he was now made into a martyr for the Nazis. Speaking at his elaborate funeral ceremony, Goebbels compared this man's sacrifice to Christ's. He commissioned music for what he called the last poem of the dead SA member and made it the official anthem of the Nazi party. The Horst Wessel Lied, the song of Horst Wessel, the credo of violence. The Red Front were the communist militias. They always wore workers' caps and Russian blouses. All these militants, men and women, were inspired by their socialist ideals. July 1932, the bloody summer of the election campaign. The SA stormtroopers, with the complicity of the police, provoked street battles with the communists. 100 dead and 1,000 wounded was the toll among the communists. Many Germans, exhausted by the disorder and the government's powerlessness, approved of the Nazis' violent acts. The result? 230 Nazis were elected to parliament. Hitler was now leader of the country's strongest political party. Power was within his reach for the first time. Quickly, however, euphoria gave way to disappointment. President Hindenburg refused to name him chancellor, head of the government. Hindenburg told Hitler, "Before God, my conscience, and the fatherland, I cannot hand over power to a party as intolerant as yours." Nevertheless, Hindenburg offered him a role in the government. But Hitler didn't consider himself an ordinary politician seeking a ministerial post. He wanted all the power to establish a totalitarian state. In a few weeks, Goebbels, the head of the vast Nazi parliamentary group, was able to paralyze democratic procedure. No majority could be formed. Then Goebbels, smiling his malicious smile, announced, "It's high time to dissolve this assembly, which no longer reflects the will of the people." Yet another election was called, the third within a year. It would take place in November. Hitler saw it as another chance to make gains. The election results were a crushing disappointment for Hitler. Surrounded by his personal SS guard, he brooded over his failure. He had lost 2 million voters and 40 seats. Goebbels said, "We've had a setback. Hitler refused to enter the government, and the voters didn't understand why." With bitterness, Goebbels read the foreign press reports. The London Daily Herald wrote, "Hitlerism as a political force is dead." The French daily, Le Populaire, edited by an eminent socialist, wrote about the end of Hitler. But they were wrong. 3 months later, Hindenburg, still facing the impossibility of forming a majority, finally named Hitler as Chancellor of Germany. To achieve his end, the wolf had disguised himself as a lamb. Hitler reassured Hindenburg by asking for only 2 ministerial portfolios for the Nazis. For the Ministry of the Interior to go to a Munich policeman named Wilhelm Frick. With Hermann Göring at his side, also to control the police. 2 key positions. Hitler advanced by subterfuge. His aim was to show that the most important ministerial positions had gone to a conservative, Franz von Papen, a former chancellor, and to the strongman of the extreme right, Alfred Hugenberg, Minister of the Economy and Agriculture, an aggressive and authoritarian hardliner. Hitler called his government the Cabinet of National Concentration to make it sound like a national coalition rather than a predominantly Nazi government. This reactionary body believed it could control Hitler. Von Papen made a dreadful mistake when he said to Hugenberg, "Hitler is our man," to which Hugenberg replied, "We oversee him." That very evening, the 30th of January 1933, in Berlin and all the other large German cities, Goebbels organized a torchlight parade of the Steel Helmet Veteran Group, the SS, and at the front, the SA stormtroopers. Goebbels declared that 1 million people marched in the parade, but the British military attaché estimated them at less than 15,000 marches, made to go around in circles for hours by Goebbels. They passed under the windows of the 85-year-old President Hindenburg, who, believing himself to be in Verdun in 1916, said to his aide, "Our men are parading well. They've taken many prisoners." Hitler, at the Chancellery, received the frenzied tribute. A Berlin schoolteacher looked on and said, "I heard people shouting, 'Death to the Jews! Jewish blood will gush under the knife.'" Goebbels concluded, "It's like a fairy tale." But this fairy tale did not have a happy ending. In February 1933, at the Berlin Sports Palace, Hitler delivered his first speech as Chancellor. What was Hitler's plan? Was he still after absolute power? There were still 200 communists and social democrats in the Reichstag. So Hitler's first move was to dissolve parliament and call new elections. His speech, filmed and broadcast on radio, was an appeal to all voters, even those on the left.
Und keine felsen fest Überzeugung, dass eben doch dann einmal die Stunde kommt, in der die Millionen, die uns heute verfluchen, hinter uns stehen und mit uns begrüßen werden dann das gemeinsam geschaffene, wieder erkämpfte, wieder erworbene neue deutsche Reich.
With this relatively conciliatory speech, Hitler continued to advance wearing a mask. Goebbels, however, wanted to stress the fundamentals, anti-Semitism and violence, for the Nazi voter base.
Sie sollen nicht bieten. Einmal wird unsere Geduld zu Ende sein und dann wird den Juden das freche Lügenmaul gestopft werden.
Only 2 weeks later, in Berlin, the Great Reichstag, the German Parliament building, burned down in the night. Nothing was left of the most powerful symbol of German democracy. The investigation carried out by the police under Göring arrested a 24-year-old Dutch communist named Marinus van der Lubbe. He was charged with arson. Quickly found guilty, he was executed. But it was the Nazis who were able to profit from this crime. Hitler and Göring raised the spectre of a red plot. Göring had 4,000 communists arrested, including all the party leaders. But the Communist Party wasn't outlawed yet. For Hitler wanted to maintain the appearance of legality for the elections which he expected would consolidate his power. The Germans, fed up with election campaigns and disorder, witnessed scenes of the stormtroopers in action all over the country to protect the population from communist attacks, as the Nazis put it. There were over 1 million stormtroopers. Now armed, they had the status of auxiliary police officers. Across Germany, they took up positions in front of the headquarters of leftist parties and workers' unions. Once again, they fomented violence, while Hitler continued to play the electoral card to reassure an increasingly exhausted President Hindenburg. Göring, in his Gothic-style armchair, fingering his dagger, gave the official doctored version of the election outcome.
Der 5. März bedeutet für einen Mann und eine Bewegung einen gewaltigen Sieg. Der Sieger des 5. heißt Adolf Hitler und die Bewegung ist der Nationalsozialismus. Beides aber ist gleichzusetzen mit dem deutschen Volke und dem deutschen Reich.
In reality, Hitler and his coalition had barely won a majority. Even with all his propaganda and the intimidation by the SA, Hitler hadn't prevented the communists from obtaining 12% of the votes. At this point, with his government behind him, Hitler tore off the mask of respectability and crossed the line to illegality. He invalidated the election of the communist parliamentarians and had them arrested and sent to the concentration camps of Oranienburg near Berlin and Dachau near Munich, which had just been built by the Nazis. These were the first of 16 camps that opened in 1933 alone. The number of political prisoners rose to 100,000 during the first months of the regime. A communist student recalled, "The guards whipped the prisoners and pushed us into freezing water. We always feared for our lives, night and day." The Nazi version was that these parliamentarians, senior civil servants and union leaders were all being re-educated. The shadow of dictatorship began to spread across Germany. Since the Reichstag had burned down, Hitler staged the new parliament in the Royal Opera House, surrounded by the SA, and demanded unlimited powers. The communist members were not there. Most were in the camps. The 94 Social Democrats who were still present managed to summon up the courage to vote against Hitler. But they too were arrested and sent to the camps, or forced to flee the country. 441 members from the extreme right to the Catholic centre listened to Hitler's long, rambling speech intended to bolster people's illusions. As always, he promised the earth, the end of unemployment, relief for peasant farmers, respect for the law, and above all, peace. The assembly then voted for its own demise by granting Hitler full powers for 4 years. No longer could President Hindenburg challenge the Chancellor's decisions. To the sound of cheering, democracy died in Germany. The fact that Hitler, whose power was based on anti-Semitism, now led one of the world's most advanced industrialized countries, was seen as a universal threat. Next, Hitler ordered a day-long boycott of Jewish-owned stores in Germany, meant as a warning. An amateur filmmaker, with the assistance of his wife, tested the determination of the Nazis posted in front of Jewish-owned businesses. Jews in Germany were horrified to see SA posters that read, "Not a penny for Jewish capitalism. Buy German," and "The Jews are the cause of our downfall." It was the beginning of the era of persecution. Anti-Semitism even contaminated the universities. Nazism was perverting the minds of young students, turning them against modern culture, imposing an intolerant ideology that would lead the students themselves to burn books, with the help of schoolchildren and directed by stormtroopers all over the country. They gathered works from libraries, bookshops, and publishing houses that reflected what Hitler described as an un-German spirit. On the Nazi blacklist were authors like Karl Marx, Sigmund Freud, Stefan Zweig, and 300 others, mainly Jewish or communist writers. 12,000 titles were condemned. Hundreds of thousands of copies were to be burnt, and the stormtroopers prepared the pyres. In a radio broadcast from Berlin's Opera Square, Goebbels read out the Sermon of the Black Mass for a ritual straight out of the Dark Ages. A young Berliner was present at the Nazi burning of the books. She described the scene. The SA and the students shouted out the book's title and its author's name. They stated if the author was Jewish, a pacifist, a feminist, or simply a modernist. They would recite, "We consign you to the fire," and would throw the book into the flames. I was dumbfounded and deeply outraged, since we had read and discussed in class many of the works that ended up in the fire. Hitler had been able to take advantage of the disunity between his enemies. The Social Democrats were unwilling to support the communists. And the communists had received their orders direct from Moscow. There was to be no alliance with the Social Democrats, who were described as traitors. Stalin's suicidal orders were a gift to Hitler. Now he had outmaneuvered all his enemies. Step by step, Hitler was able to seize absolute power in Germany. After suppressing the unions on the 21st of July 1933, he outlawed the Social Democratic Party. The German people, for their part, went away on holiday. Now the Nazi Party was the only legal party. Its anti-Semitic slogans didn't appear to stir up many people. They seemed largely indifferent to the fate of their Jewish compatriots, who, after all, only numbered 500,000, less than 1% of the population. Half the German Jews would manage to emigrate. Gerda Blachmann remembered, "We succeeded in embarking on the condition of giving up everything we owned." The poorer German Jews would be stuck in Germany. They would be deported to the eastern ghettos and finally exterminated in the camps. Opponents to the regime would flee if they could. Many went to France, where they would later be trapped by the German occupation in the war and handed back to the Nazis. But the vast majority of Germans would accept the totalitarian regime. Some would begin the day by hoisting the swastika flag, Germany's official emblem. Others, now that Hitler had muzzled the press, would read only Nazi newspapers. Their daughters, too, would learn the compulsory salute. Their sons would enter the Hitlerjugend, the Hitler Youth Movement, which would hone their aggressive tendencies. At school, teachers would show pupils how to handle weapons. Teachers would have to use down-to-earth Nazi-sanctioned examples in maths classes, such as, how much does a pupil cost? A mentally handicapped young person costs the state 1,800 marks a year, the average pupil 320 marks, and a brilliant pupil only 125 marks. Answer: society can only survive if its citizens are genetically sound. The older daughters would join the BDM, the Bund Deutscher Mädel, the League of German Girls. It trained girls to be good wives and to bear many little soldiers. But Hitler was not yet the unchallenged supreme leader. He still had to promote himself and his party through propaganda films like Victory of Faith, on the first rally since the taking of power by the Nazi Party, now the only party. Hitler was well served by the talents of the young film director Leni Riefenstahl, who charmed him with her energy and beauty. With brilliant photography and lighting techniques, she glorified the new god. She gave him a new mystique, the mystique of the leader, of power, which also elevated his apostles like the most loyal of the loyal, Rudolf Hess, one of the writers of the anti-Jewish laws. Like Joseph Goebbels, under whom propaganda had become an important ministry. Like Hermann Göring, who had revived German aviation. And like Ernst Röhm, head of that horde of fanatics, the stormtroopers. No one could have imagined that this film would be banned a year later. Because Röhm, even though he had been Hitler's accomplice since the failed putsch of 1923, was to be denounced as a traitor. Partly because he was too close to Hitler. Partly because the SA had grown too big. With 2 million members, it began to rival the army. Hitler, to gain the army's support, would have to bring them into line and eliminate Rome. In the summer of 1934, Hitler observed the maneuvers of the German army, reduced by the Treaty of Versailles to 100,000 men. Few in number, but well trained. Hitler knew that to wage war, he needed good generals, admirals, brilliant officers, great strategists, and well-drilled soldiers. He had always promised to free the army of the straitjacket of Versailles and to restore its troop and weapon strength. But the generals wanted more, in particular to get rid of Rome and his stormtroopers, who were in a position to supplant the army. Rome was also harshly criticized for having delusions of grandeur. Was he trying to set himself up as a rival to Hitler? Rome's SA rallies were looking more and more as though he was trying to steal the limelight. Hitler and Rome had been partners for 15 years, but Hitler did not hesitate. He would eliminate Rome under the pretext that he was planning a coup d'etat. Hitler then chose his executioners, Himmler, head of the SS, Heydrich, head of the Gestapo, Sepp Dietrich, who led the Führer's bodyguard. Between the 30th of June and the 2nd of July 1934, a period that Hitler called the Night of the Long Knives, the SS murdered Rome and 85 other potential opponents and embarrassing witnesses of Hitler's past. With Rome gone, the stormtroopers lost all their influence and were deployed only to keep order. The army was satisfied, as were the industrial barons. Sepp Dietrich was promoted an SS general. When Leni Riefenstahl directed her next film, Triumph of the Will, on the Nazi Party rally of 1934, only black SS uniforms were seen, marching behind Himmler. Hitler was now alone at the top of the pyramid. A month after the Night of the Long Knives, the last president of the Republic, Marshal Hindenburg, died, aged 87. Democracy had been dead and buried for a long time. Germany continued its march towards totalitarianism. Hitler now became commander of the armed forces. His power was finally absolute. Every soldier had to swear an oath of loyalty to the Führer, our leader, and the leader of the German people, Adolf Hitler. Hitler and the Nazis were good at taking credit for the successes of the Weimar Republic, such as the famous Autobahns, which became showcases for the Nazi regime. Next, Hitler and his cohorts would strike by passing the Nuremberg race laws, denying basic human rights to all Jews. He would burn synagogues to the ground in Kristallnacht, a prelude to the final solution. He would violate the Treaty of Versailles by reoccupying the zones demilitarized in 1919. The weakness shown by the lack of reaction from Britain or France would lead Mussolini to draw closer to Hitler, allowing him to annex Austria, the next step in what he called his mission, to integrate all the German-speaking peoples into a greater Germany. he would intervene in the bloody Spanish Civil War, sending his bombers to annihilate the population of Guernica. Ensuring victory for Franco's fascists over the Spanish Republicans. He dreamt of a great army, like Napoleon's. One that he would lead to Moscow. All the while proclaiming his desire for peace.
Wir wollen einst ein Reich sehen, und ihr müsst euch schon dafür erziehen. Wir wollen, dass dieses Volk einst gehorsam ist, und ihr müsst euch in dem Gehorsam üben. Wir wollen, dass dieses Volk einst friedliebend und aber auch tapfer ist, und ihr müsst friedfertig sein.
The German people, drained by Nazi pomp and propaganda, would begin to lose contact with reality. When Germany was ready, Hitler, obstinate and ferocious, would drag it and the world with it into a long, dark night of war. 50 million people would die.